You're listening to Between, Across, and Through. Take a look at the tag on your shirt. Odds are, if it wasn't made in China, your label reads Made in the Philippines. That's because the Philippines is a giant in the global garment industry, and the tremendous scale of production demanded by the West requires manufacturing to do one thing: move fast. Fast production, fast labor, fast fashion, all to move billions of dollars worth of product from the factory floor to your closet. But to say that Filipino fashion is just fast fashion would be hugely misleading. A long, slow history of Filipino couture exists among the country's powerful and wealthy. An industry that cultivates clients across generations. An industry that is totally dependent not just on the quality of the material, but also the sincerity of the labor. And elite Filipino designers will tell you that every stitch and every fold is intricate, calculated, measured. And to them, slow is magic. Today, Professor Kevin Lewis O'Neill, Director of the Center for Diaspora and Transnational Studies, sits down with Professor Denise Cruz from Columbia University to explore a world of Filipino fashion. Please join us as we travel between, across, and through.
I'm Professor Kevin Lewis O'Neill. Thank you for joining us. Professor Cruz, I'm really curious, how did you become interested in Filipino couture?
When I was growing up, my mom would often tell me these stories about her life in the Philippines and her life growing up in Manila. And part of that story involved when she would go to events or when she would have events to dress up for, she would go to designers to have clothing made. And it turns out that her brother at the time would often accompany her. And he ended up becoming a designer too, actually apprenticing with the designer that my mom would visit. And so my uncle, who is Ino Soto, is actually a well-established and rather famous designer in the Philippines. And so meeting him and getting to know him, I started to have a real appreciation for the work that he did. And to and one of the things that came up when I would talk to him about his life as a designer, I would ask him, have you ever thought of doing fashion elsewhere, fashion other than in Manila? And he would say, no, I love it here, that this life and this work is really important to me.
What's your earliest memory of your uncle?
So I was 11 years old. And we went to visit my uncle, and he lived at the time in Malate when we went up this kind of older building up the stairs and into the door. I remember very clearly the doors opening. It was a beautiful room, sort of this kind of lush white couch. And there was this beautiful screen, like kind of wooden screen in the background. And then he had fashion books on a table. And he is a very glamorous figure when you meet him. He's clearly someone who knows style and fashion. He's wearing like kind of his standard uniform is like a crisp white shirt. He has long hair and a ponytail. And we met with him, and he learned that I like to draw, and so he had me draw for him. And at the time, I was interested in drawing people, and so he sat down and looked with me, and we kind of sketched together. And so that's my first memory of my uncle. And only later on did I realize that where I met my uncle for the first time was the room that he does meetings with clients. Like, that was the actual space where he will do an initial meeting with a client. And the more I kind of began to understand his story and his career, the more I also began to see how complicated and fascinating and interesting the world of Filipino couture is.
This research seems so disruptive against what the general public might think about when they think about clothes from the Philippines, which I think the general population would think or immediately think about made to order or mass produced clothes. But this seems entirely different.
That's true. The primary way that we think about purchasing clothing in North America And about made in the Philippines in general is what's called off the rack or now online. But anyway, it's ready-made, standardized sizes. And for a long time, the Philippines has been essential to garment production. It's now been displaced by other countries where labor has been cheaper. But what would happen would be a company would have the clothing made in the Philippines, and then it would be exported out of the Philippines under that company's name. That isn't the model that I'm interested in. So the model that I'm interested in is an elite model of fashion production, in which what happens is a designer meets with an individual client. They together will work on the design. The client will participate in multiple fittings. It will be a long timeline in terms of production. And then eventually the client will have the garment.
It seems like incredibly intimate labor. Where the relationship, I assume, is absolutely essential between the client and the designer.
Yes, absolutely. And that's really important for the production of the clothing. And so what a designer, for example, what designers tell me when I ask them about their business, they say that one of their favorite things about it is working with these clients, sometimes over decades and sometimes through generations. So a designer will have an individual client, and then eventually maybe he'll end up designing for that client's children and their children's children. And you have these designer-client relationships that have extended for quite a long time. But what it means in terms of the production of clothing is that there isn't a sense of a brand that you might get with Global North fashion. So the idea that a designer or a design house like Dior, for example, or Chanel will have a designer working behind to create the brand. Here, it's a designer and an individual client. And so it creates really interesting questions, I think, both in terms of the clothing that's produced, but also the labor that's involved. So it is a really intimate process in which they're going back and forth. To observe a fitting is fascinating because the fitting in terms of the actual discussion of the dress, one designer described it to me as we talk about the dress for 5 minutes, the rest of the time is talking about the life, you know, and they'll talk to them about their lives, about their health, about, you know, what is your child doing these days? It's kind of very back and forth friendly engagement a lot of times with their closest clients. So it is a form of intimate labor, but it's also an interesting version of intimate labor because if, for example, other kinds of intimate labor, you don't really see the laborer, so the labor is displaced or the labor is rendered invisible. Here with the designer, one of the first questions that a woman is often asked when she attends an event in one of these gowns is, who did your gown? Or, I love your gown. Who did it? And so the designer's name becomes circulated attached to the gown, even though there's not a kind of corporate brand attached to it.
But with that kind of labor, there's also a heightened level of risk. If the production time takes so long, and if the relationship is really dependent upon the designer and the client, the end product, does it ever not meet expectation?
There is a high level of risk for the client. And so that's why a designer's reputation, a designer's connections or recommendations from another client is very important. And it's something that's very carefully guarded in that way. There are all sorts of things that can go wrong. So, for example, a lot of them contract with brides who, for this one day, can and are interested in spending quite a bit of money in terms of Philippine pesos for their gown. And so for that situation, there's a high level of risk because you don't know what the dress will look like until the day you put it on.
Until the day they put it on.
The day they put it on, absolutely. So what happens is you go through the series of sketches and you do three fittings or so usually. And usually what's involved is you do a sketch in conversation with the designer and you agree and you talk about materials and embellishments like beading or lace, for example. And then what happens is they create the liner for the gown. And then the bride or the client will try on the liner. So that's the initial inside architecture of the dress so that they have a sense that it's going to fit. But then after that, then you might do a kind of a secondary fitting, but not when it's like finished. So the actual completed gown often is the day itself or very close to the day itself. So although the way of doing fashion in this way has lasted for decades, it was happening, you know, before World War II, but the height of the fashion era that I'm interested in is right after World War II to the present. It's beginning to change and shift because now clients, they're becoming interested in the idea of maybe I can just try a dress on. So there were these events where I would go to where I would say, I love your gown. Who designed it? And women would say to me, as kind of whispered with a little bit of embarrassment, actually, I bought this gown off the rack.
So what is I mean, that's great. So you know, popular in North America is the show Say Yes to the Dress,
yes.
which is this tremendous ritual of women shopping for, I guess you'd call them prefabricated dresses. I mean, they're already made, they're on the rack, and sifting through and trying to find some sort of emotional connection with the dress itself. But with Filipino couture, it's that connection is not with necessarily the dress itself, but with the designer?
Absolutely. So you're not saying yes to the dress, you're saying yes to the designer. The burden for the designer is being able to craft a level of trust with the client to see if the relationship itself will work, to see if it's something that can be tenable over the course of the production of the dress. For the client has to decide, is this really something that I want? Is this someone I can trust? Is this someone who is making me feel good about the process of being able to purchase the dress? So some of the most amazing fitting sessions or some of the most amazing designer-client interactions I observed were the ones in which a designer was very skillful at being able to craft this relationship in a short amount of time. Trust me, because I'll make you look beautiful on this most important day of your life.
But does the designer ever play hard to get? I mean, so for the most successful designers, I'm sure they
yes.
don't have to drum up
to.
As much business.
Right.
And they can be quite selective. I mean, so is the
Absolutely.
Audition both ways?
Yes, the audition is both ways. So over the course of the work, so I interviewed a number of designers at all tiers. And so some of the most established to people who were just starting out. And you're right. For the most established designer, the name itself is enough and they can charge whatever they want, hundreds of thousands of pesos. So in terms of the audition being for the designer and the client as well, yes, the newer designers are the ones who are not very established. Even the ones who are mid-tier, they do have to kind of talk about the procedure to woo a client in a way to make their work seem desirable, to make them seem trustworthy. You know, I saw someone who was quite masterful at this, and he said to the client, you can make your decision, just make it, you know, now that you have all of the material. And then he kind of paused and said, well, don't wait too long because it's possible that I won't have time, you know. And at the same time, he's also saying to the bride, well, it'll be just me overseeing your dress the entire time. It's I'm going to give you highly individualized attention. So he would have to walk this very fine line between saying, you're going to be at the forefront of my mind, but also, well, you know, I'm in high demand.
And these designers have, I assume it's an apprenticeship model where people are working or training under
yes.
the main designer. And so there is kind of a shared labor. So does the main designer do the bulk of the labor?
So it depends on what kind of or how much business the designer has. But a lot of times, a designer in the Philippines often describes their work as being kind of a one-person show where they do the marketing, the client relations, overseeing the production of the dress, and the creative design itself. So often what happens is they will meet with the client and they will draw the design, and then what will happen from there, the process, is that will then go to their pattern maker. And that's someone who will create or construct the actual patterns from which the textiles will be cut. So from there, it'll go to the cutter. And from the cutter, it will go to the sewers who will construct the dress. And then from the sewers to the people who are beading or doing the lace work. And then from there to the finishers who do the kind of final touches in terms of the seams. The designer, it depends upon how much business the designer has. So the more established designers, they do have a team of people doing this. And some of them, they've been working with their team for quite a long time. But people who are just starting out, it's just that person and the sewer. And they're doing that kind of actual construction of labor themselves. And so for that kind of the designer, part of their sales pitch is, it's really me. I'm really doing everything. You are seeing the person who's going to do every single part of the design. I know how much needs to be done. I will be there on your wedding day to help you put it on. So this is something that for a younger designer, they often highlight.
It's amazing. And so returning, you had mentioned your interest in post-World War II in the industry. What shifted, or why is that an important marker? In the industry.
So in general, post-World War II is seen as an important moment in global fashion. And usually the way the story is often told is 1947 and Christian Dior and the pioneering of the new look as reinvigorating post-war interest in fashion in general. So that the kind of inspiring this conversation about what it meant to be fashionable, the idea that after the war, people were going to pay more attention or be able to pay more attention to dress. What's fascinating about that is in the Philippines, 1947, the exact same year, this is the year that a young designer named Salvacion Lim opens up a boutique in Manila. And also, I think, was pivotal to changing a nation's relationship to dress because she becomes part of a large-scale post-war fashion frenzy in the city.
And who is she? Slim.
So they now call her Slim, Salvation Lim Higgins. And so she is a Filipina designer who becomes immensely popular after the war. And there are other designers who are often talked about in this period. So Ramon Valera, for example. But Slim Higgins is really interesting as a model because she kind of starts this boutique. She becomes really affiliated with this idea of couture. So the word couture as a reference point or how people describe fashion, that really picks up in the 1940s and 1950s in part because of an interest in French fashion filtering into the Philippines where people actually start claiming the name and title of couturier. And one of the things that happens in the 1940s is that the newer elite of Manila become very interested in kind of reclaiming the social life that was in existence before Japanese occupation and with the end of the war. So Manila is rebuilding after the war. The 1950s is often talked about in the Philippines as being this kind of, very nostalgically, as being this high point of what Manila once looked like. At this time, fashion becomes a moment of cultural fascination. There are multiple fashion shows a week. It's something that the government is really interested in promoting. They want to promote the textile industry. All of these things are happening at once.
And then so in the 1950s, after World War II, couture becomes a recognizable industry, but at the same time, it seems fundamentally different than what's happening in Europe or North America.
Well, you know, I interviewed this designer, and one of the first things he said to me just as we were sitting down in his office was, you know, what's fascinating about Filipino couture, Filipino fashion, is that we're still operating the way we did in the mid-century. And that's not the case for Europe and North America. So the model, for example, when Christian Dior was actually creating fashions, was that he would create a collection, a select number of buyers and clients would be invited to the fashion show, and they would see the designs, and then it would be made for them. That was happening in the Philippines. The big change that happened was the shift to ready-to-wear in the 1960s and on, when now the bulk of fashion is really about ready-made clothing rather than bespoke.
So in the 1950s, you have the Philippines excited and the government supporting fashion. Though it seems like from your research, there's a sense that in the Philippines right now, couture is largely unregulated, not in a way that it's regulated here in Canada or in the United States.
Right. It's not formally regulated.
What does that mean?
It's structurally different in that if in other countries in the world, you have either recognition or regulation institutionally of things like textile production or of things like the being able to call yourself a couturier. What I mean is that I could, for example, go there, set up an Instagram account, say that I'm a designer, kind of promote myself. You know, there's a way in which I could try to attract clients that way, but no one would be able to say if I said I'm a couturier, no organization is going to and say to me, you're actually not a couturier. You're not able to claim that title. So there are all kinds of people at all different levels who claim a couturier, whereas this couturier in France, for example, it implies something very particular, kind of primarily handmade, a certain number of collections per year, the commitment to certain artisanal practices. You have a long history of fashion institutions and fashion schools. You have fashion archives. So for a long time in the Philippines, in terms of fashion, you didn't have these things. So while the government was really interested in promoting fashion in the Philippines in the 1950s and 60s, that fell away once there was a shift to export processing. So once you become interested in labor as the primary export model, then what ends up happening, or what has ended up happening to the fashion business there, is that you don't get that kind of government promotion or sponsorship. So when I talk to designers in the Philippines, a lot of what they say is what they wish for the future of Filipino fashion is to have more government recognition that this is an important part of the Philippines in terms of its history of art and creativity and design. What if we were to shift the idea of made in the Philippines as not being about kind of cheaply made objects or clothing, but rather something that was really an example of elite production?
So the government shifts towards made to order or mass-produced clothes because it's better for the GDP. It's better for the economy. Mm-hmm. And then what slowly gets less invested is this kind of couture as a national treasure.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of...
I think that's a...
Because some of the research seems like part of it seems to be a deliberate attempt to cultivate a certain kind of appreciation and history of this industry.
Absolutely. And I think in part because the world of Filipino fashion is poised, I think, on the edge of a transition a little bit, or it seems somewhat precarious to me now in light of what is going on elsewhere. So, you know, a lot of people in the Philippines, I think, would be quick to correct us and say that it's not an industry there, because industry implies regulation, that they would instead call it, you know, artisanal practice.
Does that mean in terms of it's not regulated, do you see examples of designers coming from outside the Philippines to try to participate, or is it so closed off that it's really difficult to get in unless you know the system?
Well, I think that most of the designers are actually from the Philippines themselves because they're familiar with the practices. When I say that the fashion in the Philippines, the reason why I want to promote it and to recover the history or to tell the history of it is because I think that as people start shopping elsewhere, the attention for fashion is shifting. And what is important about promoting fashion for me is that there's this long, beautiful history of people who have created these really stunning gowns that are wearable, but I think also function as art objects. And there's a whole set of practices. So some of the designers that I've talked to who are, you know, thinking about retirement, a number of them think about their desire to teach or to start a school, in part because they want to craft these techniques that they see as no longer in circulation. There's a whole kind of artisanal practice. You know, I would talk to designers and they would say, there's this a pair of sisters who for a long time have crafted these beautiful silk flowers that we used to use for embellishments on a dress. Those sisters are very old now, but they're seen as the last people in Manila who know how to do this kind of craft. What will happen to them? You know, so you have this history of people who make beautiful things in competition with, say, a generation of people in the Philippines who don't want to take up that practice because instead a job at the call center is going to make so much more money for them than doing this kind of work.
There's such an interesting inversion here. So as an anthropologist, you know, I oftentimes think about or read about things like cultural survival, which was this kind of moment in anthropology about making sure that languages that were going extinct should be documented and cultural practices that should be documented. The interesting inversion here is that the artisanal cultural practices here aren't from, quote-unquote, below,
mm-hmm.
If we're doing this kind of a spatial mm-hmm. metaphor of class structure, but mm-hmm. actually quite elite and from above. And you have, for what lack of a better word, global capitalism really putting this artisanal labor at risk.
Yes. And I think that's one of the most fascinating things about the work for me is I think a lot of times as scholars, or at least in scholarly production, there's a little bit of discomfort with talking about the elite, especially in relationship to capitalism, that for good reason, we've looked at the ways in which global capitalism and the production of objects or consumer products has affected laborers. And that's been really important. And certainly for the Philippines, a lot of really important and interesting work has been done about the exporting of labor. So I'm thinking here of phenomena like domestic caregivers or nurses, the idea that Filipino citizens go out and care for the global north. But the world of Manila Couture is fascinating to me in part because here we have a group of men and women, many of them who I would identify as queer men and women who have become involved with the elite, have been essential to that power structure in Manila. And so what happens when you shift the stage in terms of labor from the traditional notion of laboring bodies for us to instead more elite producers? What happens is you see a whole new set of archives and subjects that weren't formally visible. What happens is you see this group of, for example, gay men who are really essential to making some of the most powerful women in the city look beautiful. And in the Philippines, looking beautiful has had a long history of actually manifesting political power.
Of course. And in the Philippines also, which is... with my understanding, a strongly dominant Catholic culture, couture becomes an arena where gay men can articulate their professional ambitions, it seems.
Absolutely. And so, you know, you have designers, for example, saying, I became interested in fashion in the 1960s. And, you know, they would see in the 1960s, fashion became a place where they could craft their interest in art. You know, a designer's talking about when I was younger, I used to love to make clothing and paper dolls, and or I was interested in beauty. And my parents instead maybe wanted me to major in something else, in business or in the sciences. We have that even with contemporary designers now, where fashion becomes a space for them to be visible in a new way. Now, you know, the history of kind of queerness in the Philippines is different from that in the global north. But what is important is that they're still marked both in the print archive and in the memories of the people who talk about that era as being gay.
And so much of your work for me sounds like an effort to wrestle with questions of temporality. And so earlier you were speaking about these questions about fast production and slow production and people maybe not having the attention span right now to engage this kind of artisanal labor. Mm-hmm. What are some of your reflections on this notion of temporality? And is it a question of just attention span? And then the expectations of these consumers have changed so radically because of other structural issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in terms of temporality, I think I would start... Or I would ask people, you know, do you feel pressure from things like global fashion from China or fast fashion? And I really remember I had a conversation with a journalist who's been covering fashion for a long time. And she said something that really been returning to in the course of writing. And what she said was, you know, you're saying that because you're not from here. The thing about Filipino fashion or fashion design in the way that we do it here is that it's always been like this, and it will always be like this. So despite fast fashion, global fashion, Asian fashion, whatever these developments are, Filipino fashion will always be here. And I found that really fascinating as a disruption of what I had assumed would be, you know, even now I've talked about it as being somewhat precarious. In the end, I differ with that journalist, but one of the things that I find so useful about the statement, Filipino fashion has and will always be there, is the idea that Filipino fashion has sustained and been present, has kind of weathered the storm of globalization in really interesting and unexpected ways, in ways that we wouldn't think of. And that's really fascinating to me, is to think about, rather than, for example, the way to survive in fashion today is to create fast, quick runs of clothing that's going to satisfy a customer who's constantly looking for a new trend. No, the way to survive and sustain in fashion is to craft a close, intimate, personal relationship that will extend through decades and through generations of a family. It's a completely different way, I think, of approaching, for me, globalization and effects on time and labor and intimacy.
And it completely reaffirms your statement that the designer's name is critical here.
Mm-hmm.
The entire
mm-hmm.
industry rests on that intimate relationship, multi-generational relationship, mm-hmm. with just the designer's name. How is it working with the designers?
First of all, they're really interested in talking to people about their work, and they've been really welcoming to me. I did a lot of kind of cold reaching out to people. I think they enjoyed being able to talk about the history of fashion. And what often happened in initial meetings is that the designers themselves would connect me immediately to other people. So one of the things about that's interesting about my conversations with these designers is that people are always kind of curious, like, okay, but it was really kind of competitive. And I'm sure it must have been people were like gossipy or kind of there was a lot of rivalry with the designers. And that's actually not what I encountered in terms of the conversations with the designers themselves. Like, competitive rivalries did come up over the course of my kind of longer relationship with them. However, in a lot of the conversations, what they would often say is that we would start talking about their work, and maybe 5 minutes in, they would say, you know who you should really talk to is my friend and colleague here. That it was kind of constantly, let's create a giant lattice structure to help provide as much information as possible.
I've always found, I mean, in research that's oftentimes thematically very different than this one, but in overlooked industries or industries that really want to be recognized, that there can oftentimes be a very warm welcome to a outside researcher who asks informative, very sincere questions.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I found that too. A lot of people were interested too in having someone have the resources to be able to dedicate to doing the archival research and to tracing the history and kind of connecting the stories together.
Because you speak about sustaining, which is oftentimes, at least how I understand it, very designer focused. Which, and I'd love to hear you speak more about that. But it also seems that through your research, there may be a collective interest in some sort of larger sustaining of the system or the industry or whatever. But could you say a little more about sustaining?
Sure, absolutely. So sustaining is a word that came up when I was asking a very established designer about a kind of long-term goals for someone in fashion in Manila. And what the more established designers would often say would be, what really matters in the business is your ability to sustain. So they would use words like to endure or to last, to go beyond an initial noticing and to have a career that can extend through years and decades.
And that's not just a financial distinction. It's not just to keep running.
No, it's not just to keep running. It's also, I think, the idea of temporal lastingness or persistence. And so I became interested in thinking about how these designers discuss sustaining, because it was really grounded in what I saw as the present, in terms of a almost lateral lastingness or persistence that was different than what I was seeing in terms of other discussions of time. There have been many scholars who have now written about critiques of capitalism and time and globalization and time is kind of moving towards constant acceleration or linear movement. But a lot of these scholars, I think, talk about it in terms of rupture or breaking away. And so I became really interested in this idea of really lasting materially, relationally, and in terms of a business model.
It makes perfect sense when you think about the kind of, again, cultural survival is not the right word here, but it mm-hmm. is about thinking through this this industry, this couture, as trying to establish a history and sustain this kind of respect for it. It's also struck me, and I don't know, as a scholar, mm-hmm. sustaining also seems like a metaphor for creative production that mm-hmm. that, you know, we would think is quite familiar.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not just about an initial idea, but a lifetime of creative production.
Yes, and I think that's really critical for them. Although it's interesting too, because you know, so many of them don't have a brand attached to their name. A lot of them talk about their work as kind of, they will do this work, but when they're finished, they're not going to pass on their name to someone else. That it will be for their personal lifetime. There's not that sense, for example, that the brand of one of these designers is going to necessarily live on. So I think there's a real heightened awareness of the kind of work they can do in this moment.
I'm Kevin Lewis O'Neill, and you're listening to the CDTS podcast. We're speaking from the Center for Diaspora and Transnational Studies at the University of Toronto. The center works as an incubator for research across the humanities and the social sciences. We've been talking with Professor Denise Cruz from the Department of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University, exploring the themes of fashion, nationalism, and the aesthetics of power. We've talked about the precarity of an industry that for the Western world is sometimes associated with cheap labor and disposable fashion, but has another equally important side, the artisanal labor of high fashion. So a big part of your work is looking at the transnational dimensions of Filipino fashion. Could you tell us a little bit about Toronto Fashion Week and Project Runway in terms of, in light of the transnational or even just like the mobile dimensions of Filipino fashion?
Yes. So there are transnational elements to Filipino fashion in terms of designers who have traveled elsewhere and in terms of designers who promote their work elsewhere. So there are traveling fashion shows for the Philippines. There was a show based here in Toronto called Canada Philippine Fashion Week. It was a kind of celebrity designer charity event. That's no longer a regular event, although Filipino designers do travel elsewhere. But the idea of traveling fashion shows for the Philippines is actually something that has been in existence with Filipino fashion more generally for about, I would say, 4 or 5 decades or since the 1960s. Because the question for the fashion designers in the Philippines then was, they were interested in entertaining the idea, can we export this model globally? They were fascinated with that. And so one of the things that they started to do was they started to do these fashion shows, which were immensely popular in Manila and other areas of the Philippines. So there was a show called Fashion on Wings, where 8 different designers actually traveled, did the touring fashion show through different regions of the Philippines. And it's fascinating to see what happened to these shows because they accorded immense audiences. So I'm talking, the final show was at Araneta Coliseum, which is the same place where Muhammad Ali, the Thriller in Manila fight was.
Oh my goodness.
So that same Coliseum fills to 25,000 people watching the last night of a fashion event in the 1960s. And it is amazing to see the photos documenting that event. So once this idea of what I call the fashion palabas, and palabas is a word in Tagalog that means kind of show and spectacle. This traveling palabas, they think, okay, it worked in this national sense. Can it work internationally in the Philippines? And so then they start doing shows at the World's Fair or in New York or Seattle.
But at the World's Fair, it would be reframed entirely.
Oh, yeah, totally. So the context is different. And this is where the reframing is fascinating and that I think has long-term ramifications. Okay, so the traveling fashion shows within the Philippines, it's accompanied by a press discourse or a media fascination with these designers and also with the models, because part of it was seeing these models and these very glamorous gowns. So people know these names. But when you export to a place like the United States, you don't have that prior knowledge of the Filipino designers. So then what becomes the most marketable are things like embroidery or fabric.
Oh, wow.
So interestingly, I think part of what I try to document is the ways in which the traveling international fashion show, you get the shift that ends up having long-term repercussions away from design and aesthetics of design, instead to labor in terms of technique with embroidery, in terms of the creation of a textile that isn't available in North America.
So it's from something like from fashion to folklore that it gets repurposed in a way.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. And there's other scholars who have talked about this, but I think that's absolutely true. Like, what happens when this local cultural practice travels elsewhere without that context? How do people kind of conceive of it or react to it? So now if you go to Manila, and if you were there in, say, the last 10 years, you would know that Project Runway was a show, of course, popular here and elsewhere. So they have a Project Runway Philippines.
Excellent.
With a cast where there's a mentor designer, there's a cast of judges, there is a supermodel host, and they work with local designers, and it's the same exact same kind of model. So if you were to come to that new, you would think maybe, oh, this is a show that has been imported from the global north into the Philippines. No, actually, that show, that model may have been in existence elsewhere, but the interest in it has a longer historical arc in which the fashion palabas became a cultural entertainment that could attract 25,000 paying customers to fill a coliseum. There's this 1960s article that says, I think that fashion may have deposed basketball as the Philippines' preferred form of national entertainment.
That is extraordinary.
Yeah.
That is extraordinary. But then, and then so Project Runway emerges in the Philippines. You're right. So it's based on this longer history of interest in fashion, this mm-hmm. effervescent excitement about mm-hmm. fashion that is at least 50 years old. Though then it becomes packaged in this easily reproducible, I mean, almost, you know, it's not fast fashion, but mm-hmm. the form of entertainment is quite speedy in its mm-hmm. reproduction. It's almost off the rack television that's battling with this really high-end elite couture.
Right.
That's fantastic.
Right, this longer history. And so there's all kinds of repackaging. I mean, Melda Marcos is globally famous, of course, for being one of the most prominent political figures to wear Filipino designers when she traveled. And one of her signature dresses was, it's called Laterno. It has these large butterfly, they're called butterfly sleeves. And so she becomes iconic in fashion. And so Imelda Marcos is someone that even a younger generation of people in the Philippines refer to. So people have been in fashion for a long time. What they're interested in is, okay, Imelda Marcos, you know, the younger generation remembers her. But she was actually capitalizing on this longer history of fashion and spectacle, of the connection between beauty and power and intimacy.
And the system extends all the way to North America with mm-hmm. Toronto Fashion Week. And so mm-hmm. Toronto Fashion Week, or at least Filipino Fashion Week, is that what?
It was called Canada Philippine Fashion Week. So Toronto has a Fashion Week. So Fashion Week is a marketing event that people attribute to Eleanor Lambert, who is this New York publicist, basically, who said, okay, how are we going to attract U.S. consumers to U.S. designers rather than in Paris? And so she comes up with the idea of what she calls Press Week. And you invite buyers and press representatives and fashion influencers with a very curated audience. And then you have designers show their collections, okay? Now there are fashion weeks everywhere in places like Toronto or Phoenix, Arizona, for example, all over the world, because it's become now a kind of tourist event in which people recognize that people are interested in fashion. You can get people to come to the city in order to participate in Fashion Week. The difference is that these events are ticketed and available to the public. So,
and that's kind of strange, because in the past, I would have to be invited. I would have to be in the circle. But now anyone
can be invited. Right. So it's still the case in Paris where that's not, you cannot buy a ticket to Paris. I mean, you can through, I guess, various agencies. But the process in Paris, for example, is still, you need to be accredited. You need to be kind of, you actually have to have an address in Paris to get an invitation. So Canada Philippine Fashion Week was not an event in which, for example, a buyer will go and buy a place an order that will later be filled. It was primarily for Filipinos in the diaspora who wanted a connection to a practice that they either remember or are familiar with or know of. They want to see Filipino designers. And for that reason, Canada Philippine Fashion Week looks very different than Fashion Week in Paris.
And then how did it go in Toronto? You spoke a little bit about the difficulty of moving these these shows outside of the bounds of the nation state with reception.
Mm-hmm.
How did it go?
It's interesting because in part, one of the things that the event did was it highlighted the diversity of, I would say, the Filipino community in Toronto. And so there's parts of that community that has been here for a long time. There's also kind of people in their 20s and 30s who now have their own careers and have disposable income. There's also, of course, the large diasporic caregiver community in the Philippines. So there are all these various components of the Filipino community there. And again, this was to raise money for charity. But the tickets were also scaled, so there was a kind of more affordable show all the way up to the final finale show.
Filipino fashion here in Canada, I assume, can be an engine for community building, but maybe it's also a moment that would accentuate some differences.
Yes, and that's absolutely the case that in terms of what I saw with Canada Philippine Fashion Week, which was supposed to be a celebratory event. So the idea was that you would go and you would see these designers and this show. You would participate, again, in this elite form of entertainment. Canada Philippine Fashion Week as an event was also different because it was really promoting the Philippines as a tourist site. So it was sponsored in part by Philippine Airlines. There were images of islands on screens in the background. There was a moment when you sang the Philippine national anthem. There was food involved. There was a roasted pig that went down the runway at one point because it was a community event.
So tell me that again. So
yes.
So a roasted pig down the runway.
Right. So they called it. So at the kind of the first show, it was an event that coincided with celebration of Philippine nationalism. And so there were references to Jose Rizal, who is an important literary figure in the Philippines. There was a moment where everybody sang the national anthem. There was much talk about celebrating the Philippines with pride and with style. And for this kind of community event, really essential always in terms of Filipino culture is the food. And so at a break in between the display of fashion, the MC got up and said, okay, now we are going to have what he called the parade of lechon, which was a parade of roasted pig. And so this fully dressed roasted pig comes down the runway and people are taking photos of it. And the audience quite enjoyed that moment. And then they passed out kind of takeout containers of the pig for people to eat while you watched the show. So on one hand, that is not something that would happen at a fashion show in Manila. So it speaks in part to the diasporic context and to the different community who would be attending that event. That event was also, again, supposed to be celebratory. So there were performances involved, and one of the performers sang a song. And to introduce the song, she said, "I would like to dedicate this to the many Filipinos throughout the world who are caregivers." And in that moment, it was this kind of interesting reminder of the presence of global Filipino labor, which on one hand, and this is how I talk about it in the article related to this, is that it's a highly visible story in terms of the figure that is going to come up is the, in many cases, the caregiver. Yet at the same time, within the city of Toronto, that labor is displaced and rendered invisible. So it was a moment of conflict in that space where a community was being asked to recognize members who are a part of that community, but not all of the community necessarily wanted to talk about that because it was supposed to be a celebratory national event.
And it seems that in your research, fashion is a form of labor, but it's also a kind of aspirational endeavor. So when the journalist says, you know, there was Filipino fashion in the past, there it is right now, and will always be there, that seems to be both a statement of fact, but also an aspiration.
Yes.
Almost like a political project.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can imagine that when the complexity of a community gets recognized in a fashion and in a fashion event, which is supposed to be aspirational, that there could be some pushback.
Yes. Yeah. So there is definitely, and that definitely, I think, happened, or you could see it visibly in terms of my perception of the emotional reaction of the people in the audience, their enthusiasm for, say, you know, let's all sing a Filipino song that we all know and love, to this moment where let's dedicate the next song to caregivers, right. There was a quite different feeling in the room.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then so back in Manila, when it in this fashion event filled the stadium, I assume that was a fairly diverse
yes.
crowd also.
Also because they were ticketed. And so the other thing, yeah. because, okay, so it's important to know that usually for Fashion Week, there's a time lag. So there's a time lag of, say, 3 months in which people will buy, but then they know that that isn't going to be available to consumers for a few months. These kinds of fashion shows in which 25,000 people were attending were very, very different because it's before that ready-to-wear model existed. Again, this is the 1960s, the early 1960s when this is happening. The audience was comprised of people who are hearing about fashion, who are interested, who maybe want to participate in this elite cultural practice.
Right. I want to talk a little bit again about the designers and the specificity of the designer's name and the reputation of each designer. I understand that at this point in your research, you've decided not to use the names of designers, which isn't unusual for ethnographic and archival research in terms of preserving anonymity. It's slightly interesting in that sense that they're presumably elite public figures, though the more I hear about fashion and couture in the Philippines, it seems that the ecosystem is so sensitive is the wrong word, but and volatile certainly isn't, but someone's name is their entire livelihood.
Absolutely.
So I wonder, could you talk us through a little bit about questions of anonymity
sure.
In the research?
And that was a really difficult question because one of my interviews actually asked me, okay, you're writing the history of Philippine fashion, I'm going to talk to you, but you're not going to use my name in the actual writing. So it was a hard decision for me because on one hand, I want to recognize certain designers. So for the historical parts of the book, absolutely there are designers' names. But for the chapters that really delve into the contemporary dynamics, because as you're talking about, it is a very delicate ecosystem. And in terms of designers' reputations, it's so carefully guarded that I was worried about, you know, being able for a designer to speak candidly with me about, say, the process through which the designer, you know, works with a client. You know, that's something that I had to be really careful of. But it wasn't just the names, right? Because one of the things, too, in terms of how does a designer craft recognition? Okay, so for example, there are designers who have a long history with a certain kind of style or technique. And so when somebody sees their gown in public, you can know who that designer is based on that technique. So maybe it's a certain kind of embroidery or a certain kind of draping of a dress, a certain line, a certain kind of embellishment, okay? And so I also had to be careful in terms of anonymity of kind of naming various practices. So sometimes what I end up doing is talk about people in terms of accumulated identities.
Sure,
In order, because in order to say I talked at length about a certain style or technique of production, people would know exactly who I'm talking about.
So it's kind of like a composite collar yeah. or something. Like
right.
It's to make sure that the identity, and what's powerful here is that, you know, someone like me who will obviously read the book and learn a great deal won't know much at all and won't identify anything. But you're in a position which many academics don't find themselves, where your informants will read the book.
Yes.
And that seems to be the very, very specific audience that you're trying to be respectful towards.
Yes, absolutely. And that's been really challenging. It's been exciting and challenging at the same time. How do you represent the complexity of this world in a detailed and specific way that will come alive for people who aren't familiar with it, but how do you also honor the actual practices of the people who are living there?
And because you have also, you know, a piece of your life or family in this industry,
mm-hmm.
that it's about maintaining the relationships that you're cultivating and that your family
mm-hmm.
has cultivated.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of as fading out from this conversation, why do you find the labor of the designers in particular so compelling with this research?
They're in this very interesting position, in part because they're highly visible. A number of the designers I've spoken with do identify as gay. They have a level of celebrity. So that's one population. There's also a population of women designers who also within the local story of Filipino fashion, that story has also been undertold because the gay celebrity designer is the one that has kind of acquired a lot of public attention. So these two populations I was really interested in exploring. And I think those two populations only emerged when I looked at the designer. So it was a combination, I would say, of my own interest in telling the story and also, frankly, of access.
Having been raised in the United States, mm-hmm. does your, for lack of a better word, Americanness help in the field work? Is it seen as an advantage, an edge? The Americanist thing always plays differently,
right? I would say it is not seen as
yeah, it could not be.
I'm very clearly marked as an outsider.
Yeah.
I guess it's an edge in that they see me as someone with scholarly and genuine interest in the work, who has enough of a connection to it and enough of a professional and scholarly interest in it that they want to be able to tell me this information. But for sure, I would say that I'm marked as an outsider. In part of what was difficult was also being able to pass in these fashion events.
I'm sure.
As somebody of this world.
Mm. So yeah. Passes in. So you have to buy nicer fieldwork clothes than I do.
And So I remember when I was working with one of my research assistants, when I was giving her instructions about things that she might want to bring to the Philippines. And one of them, I asked her, do you have a floor length gown?
That's
because
absurd.
We will need that
right.
for the events that we're going to attend.
Pack it.
Now, the reason why I know that is that early on in my research, I was invited to a fashion show that was at the opening of a ballroom. It was like cocktail hour. Okay. And so I arrive at this event and I'm wearing a dress that my uncle has designed for me. And it's a beautiful, well-draped, kind of perfectly executed teal above-the-knee cocktail dress. And I come into this event, and everyone there is wearing floor-length gowns, their hair's done up, there's a red carpet, there's kind of incredible amount of jewelry, impressively, professionally applied makeup. And I'm instantly marked as an outsider, someone who has forgotten that this is the mode of dress in the Philippines in terms of social events. And it ended up working out fine because I was able to, the kind of marking of myself as an outsider. People are very kind in that. So no one shuns you if it was not my experience that I was shunned for what I was wearing, but certainly there was greater care and attention because I had to be in these events.
And then so back in Manila, completely aloof can be helpful in the field.
Mm-hmm.
So that maybe is not...
Right.
Maybe you got more interesting
right.
stuff because of it.
I think in part my inability to pass sometimes
right.
was helpful because then they approached it quite generously.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for joining.
You're welcome.
That was Professor Kevin Lewis-Anil in conversation with Professor Denise Cruz from Columbia University. On our next episode, we'll talk to Professor V.K. Preston, and we'll ask the questions, can you appropriate dance? And what did 17th century ballet have to do with protesting against colonialism in Peru? Please subscribe on your favorite app so you won't miss it. This monthly podcast was brought to you by the Center for Diaspora and Transnational Studies at the University of Toronto. I am Yane Romero. Thank you for listening and joining the conversation.